talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
As one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, Ireland's forgotten film pioneers, the Horgan brothers of Youghal, and how three visionary siblings captured a rapidly changing Ireland through their photographs, their animation, and their newsreels. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. Thomas, James and Philip Horgan were born and raised in Youghal, County Cork, and together pioneered photography, animation and film exhibition in early 20th century Ireland. In tonight's show, we want to explore how the Horgan brothers lit up Ireland with the magic of the moving image. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Doreena Clancy is a director and producer and the creative director of Cormorant Films, and she's the author of The Horgan Brothers, The Irish Lumieres, published by the Mercier Press, and the book accompanies the wonderful T.G. Cahir documentary that she produced called Na Lumiere Gaeilge, and the book and the documentary was the culmination of years of research into the lives and legacy of the Horgan Brothers. Professor Ruth Barton of the School of Creative Arts at Trinity College Dublin is one of the world's leading authorities on Irish cinema. A professor in film studies and member of the Royal Irish Academy, her work spans from the silent era to 21st century film, and her books include Irish National Cinema, Rex Ingram and Hedy Lamarr, The Most Beautiful Woman in Film. Dr. Dennis Condon lectures in film at the Departments of English and Media Studies at Maynooth University, an expert on Irish cinema histories and local exhibition cultures. He's the author of Early Irish Cinema, 1895 to 1921. Well, you're all very welcome. And Doreena, I might begin with you, and I might begin with a question about these brothers and why you call them the Irish Lumieres.
The Irish Lumieres, they were working and operating in Ireland around the time that the Lumiere brothers of France first discovered or developed the camera that we all know now to be the camera of cinema. And these brothers were literally working in toe step to these gentlemen in France at the time, and buying their cameras from them, adapting them, tinkering with them at home so that they could turn them into projectors or cameras, or developing the film themselves so they didn't have to send it to London to be developed. So that's why I have christened them the Irish Lumieres.
And your interest in them was sparked as a child growing up because you heard stories about the theatre and about the photographs and about the work that they had done.
So the Horgan Cinema was in existence really from 1917 until the 1980s. So the last of the Horgan Cinema, let's say, would have been shown things like Jaws and Superman, which would have been in my time. So we knew the Horgans. We grew up knowing the Horgans and knowing of their work. Vaguely, but there was no one place where you could actually get all of the information. There was strands of it in the IFI, for example. So when I moved to Dublin in the 90s, I, you know, realised the importance of the Horgan brothers when I was there, because the IFI was making a big deal, a very big deal, of their films, because they had, you know, they had saved them and they had digitized them, reproduced them, and you know, they curate them now. But, you know, at the time, for me, it was a bit of a revelation because it was something that we just took for granted at home. And then all of a sudden when I was in Dublin, I was like, oh, these guys must be a bit of a bigger deal than I thought, you know. You know, they'd always been on my radar, but it wasn't really until, you know, a few years ago that I really discovered the right way to tell the story of the Horgan brothers, making it tangible and accessible to the public, you know, because it's quite academic sometimes when you read about it. But this way, the way that I produced the documentary was really just to kind of go, these guys were at the start of cinema. These guys were there in the middle of it. And these guys' films are actually the oldest surviving Irish-made films in Ireland and animation, which is really cool.
And Dorina, do you think there's an element of, you know, anti-country, anti-rural bias in it, that if the Horgan brothers had been working and doing all of this in Dublin, they probably would have been more remembered in the Irish cultural memory?
There is no doubt in my mind, as somebody who, you know, my opinion is that, you know, as somebody who's worked and lived in Dublin and around Europe, that there is definitely that bias against their story. Whilst the IFI have been, you know, incredible at promoting the films, they just never seemed to get the recognition that they deserve, to be quite honest, in the national zeitgeist and national, you know, recognition in terms of the achievements that they, you know, the things that they developed in terms of early cinema. But, you know, the things that these guys were doing were right there at the cusp of what everybody else was doing, very, very close to what the Lumières were doing at the time, you know.
And Dorina, tell us about the brothers, who they were, and was James the leader of the siblings? Because I know that the Galway Film Fla commemorates his work by awarding the James Horgan Award every year. So he seems to be credited as the visionary, even though they were all significant.
So Thomas seemed to be the guy, the brother who was in charge of the business. And that's very evident in all of the cinematic records that are held again in the IFI, you know, in terms of the cinema books, the accounts, all that sort of thing, that was all Thomas. Then James was very, you know, charismatic. He was really good with people. He was really into music. He was really into drama. He was, you know, in what really strikes me about the photographic collection is that there he really is having a lot of fun, which is not something you traditionally see in photographs of that era. So for me, the photographs are just incredible. There's a beautiful one of him holding a camera, and he's inscribed on the glass plate, "Mildly," and it's I love that photograph. But James was very charismatic. Philip, though, was just as creative in a lot of ways, but just a little quieter. He never married, but a lot of the postcard business and a lot of the photographs of different places around the hinterland of Youghal, they are actually Philip's photographs, as research has uncovered. They are actually the photographs of Philip. And a lot of the photographs that would have been featured in the Evening Echo in the 30s, they're Philip's photographs as well, rather than James's photographs. But James certainly seemed to be the most charismatic of the three, and he was certainly the man behind the animation, you know, the 12 seconds of animation film that remains of the Clock 8 swirling and twirling around the main street in Youghal, and is the iconic award for animation at the Galway Film Club. That were the three brothers. They were very different in personality and led very different lives as well, it must be said. And, you know, there's only so much space in a documentary that you can actually explain those things. But their lives went in three different trajectories, even though they worked together very, very closely all their lives.
And Dennis, you're doing brilliant work mapping local cinema culture all over Ireland, from Belfast to Skibbereen. And I'm wondering, where do the Horgans fit into that? And I know you're also working on the Irishness of Irish cinemas during the silent period. And again, you know, how significant is the work that the Horgan brothers was doing?
I mean, it's very significant. It's great to see somebody bringing them into the limelight, as Dorina has done with her film book that is now to be published. So I'm delighted to see attention being brought to early cinema in Ireland through those projects. For me, the Horgans fit within that landscape of early cinema and early exhibition. That would be the cinema owners and so on. But they have an extra dimension in that they're also filmmakers. And what's really important for Ireland and our visual heritage is that so much of that material survives. For other cinema owners and others who would have been making films as well at this time, really nothing survives. So it's just fantastic to have the material from the Horgans and to be able to make a film that Dorina has made.
So there probably were other families and other individuals across the island doing similar work, maybe not perhaps as innovative, although perhaps maybe some were doing great stuff, but it hasn't survived. We don't have the archival material, and therefore their stories and their contributions are lost.
Yeah, there's tiny traces of others who were working in the area. I think of the Kilgannons in Sligo, for example, who are also photographers, and also set up two cinemas in Sligo. And they made films, the film Survive. I think of J.T. Jameson in Dublin, and who set up cinemas in the circuit all around Ireland, and who made the first films of the GAA, for example, which, again, don't survive. But he made many local films, but also ones that, if we had, they would be extremely valuable for our heritage. But they do, we have tiny archival traces of these films that, not images from or anything like that, but mentions and articles about people going to see them and so on. But it's hard to put together a documentary on something like that. It's, you know, there's no visual material really, apart from the Horgans. The Horgans is the most we have really of the that visual heritage from that time.
And Ruth, it is very interesting the way Irish people who were going to the cinema were going to have to get their newsreels and get their news from Pathé newsreels, and they were getting this colonial bias and the imperial gaze of these new newsreels. And in a way, the Horgans were challenging that with their own productions.
Yeah, very certainly. I mean, one of the big problems, particularly maybe, you know, slightly, you know, in the mid 1900s, so really around the revolution, you've got a huge problem because, for a start, the people filming the events of 1916 were Pathé and foreign operators. So they were clearly filming them not for an Irish audience, for a British audience. And so, and those are the ones that have been kept. So when we now go and see documentaries, and you know how if you go to see a documentary about 1916 or about events in Ireland, you know, from revolutionary period onwards, they often run footage of those events, but they're not seen from an Irish eye. And I think that's hugely important to remember, that you know now we almost kind of understand we need our own news. But we needed our own newsreels then, because that was people, they had radios, they didn't have TV. So people were getting their news by going to the cinema, and they weren't getting Irish news apart from the few, as Dennis has mentioned, the very few local filmmakers who were shooting Irish events. Now, of course, one of the things about the Horgan brothers was much of what's been retained, and it's difficult to know exactly, you know, what we're missing, is of local events that are sort of apolitical. And I know that they did film a Sinn Féin march from 1916, so there may have been more of that. But I think what's also so important for us is that these are films that are an amazing record of Irish life of the time.
And do we get a sense of what they were interested in? Because I don't get the feeling really that they were as concerned about politics. Maybe it was local events and what was going on in the communities that really excited them.
Yeah, I think so. Because what they were doing was, on the one hand, something they enjoyed doing. But on the other hand, so they'd opened their cinema in Youghal, and they were based in Youghal. And they opened the Horgan Picture Theatre then, which was a big cinema, a big deal, 600-seater cinema. And that was in 1917. They had to then fill it. And one of the ways that you could guarantee people coming to the cinema was to see themselves. So if they had shot, you know, one of the films you can see on the IFI collection, for instance, is a short reel called Leaving Church. And if you play it, you can see it's just people streaming out of church. And again, it's a reminder of just how massive church attendance was at the time. But also all those people knew that if they went to the cinema that night, they'd see themselves on the screen. And, you know, we still love seeing ourselves on the screen. So it was it played, you know, two very valuable purposes, which was to capture local life, but also to get people to come to the cinema to see themselves on the screen. So they were sound business people, as well as, you know, having this kind of amazing artistic eye, if you like.
Yeah, Dorina, let's maybe talk about that artistic eye and the success of them as photographers and the things that they were capturing in terms of World War I soldiers returning home, or those who trying to capture those who perhaps might never return home. And they really had a kind of an eye for telling some of these remarkable stories.
It's incredible now that when you look back at them, they really were the heart of pretty much anything that was going on in the town. And again, you got to remember that they were going right out into the hinterlands of Youghal as well. They weren't just based in that place. So they were going as far away as Lismore and Capquin in County Waterford. And on the other side, they were going to Ballymacoda and Ladysbridge. So that's, you know, in those days, that's quite a span geographically. So they were photographing, you know, communions, confirmations, weddings, graduations, but they were doing it in the local community hall. So they would cycle, or eventually they got a car, so they drove to these places and they would set up a studio and they were there to capture the photographs. But not only that, when there was something happening in the town or the village, they were there. So if it was a Corpus Christi procession, they were there. When during the Civil War, the quays were bombed, they photographed quays in ruins. They, you know, later on in the 50s, they filmed the filming of Moby Dick. But they also, really interestingly for me, there are so many photographs that are on their own in isolation, for example, of Lord Carberry flying over the volunteer camp. You know, and there's a whole story about, you know, Lord Carberry in an airplane in the early 1900s flying over where people thought, you know, the Germans were coming, that there was a war starting. You know, they just didn't know what an airplane was. And then there were visitors, because Youghal was such a huge port, multinational town, that there was these visitors coming in from all these exotic places, and they were there to photograph those visits as well. It was expected that the Horgans would go to photograph. It was almost, you know, come along, James or Phil or Thomas, to photograph the events. And it was expected that they would be there because they were part of the fabric of the community at that stage. Again, I really have to stress about their photographs. None of them seem posed or overstrained in their poses. You know, everybody seems really relaxed and very familiar with the people behind the camera and the camera itself. So there's no kind of stilted portraiture there. There's a fantastic one of the Raj of Sarawak on the steps of Myrtle Grove. And because it's a glass plate, it's broken, but we still have a fragment of that photograph. And there's another one of the gates of Camtin, and there's a magnificent story behind that. And otherwise, if we did not have that glass plate, we would not have known today, other than an obscure academic paper that was written in Hong Kong, we wouldn't know that those gates were actually in Youghal, but for the Horgan photographs. So I think if you look at them today, they really were social historians because they put themselves everywhere. So whether people were swimming, whether there was a big occasion at the beach, you know, whether they were filming the poor people's excursion from Cork, you know, all of those things, they were there for all of us. And they just, that was what they did. And then on the quieter days, they would go up the Blackwater on the boat and film and take beautiful scenic shots and then turn them into photographs. And those photographs in turn went all over the world in the form of postcards, which was a very lucrative business for them.
Ruth, I wonder how technically innovative the Horgan brothers were when we look at the film industry and everything that was happening in the world at that time. Were they breaking new ground, or were they just reflecting innovations that were happening elsewhere?
I think for the main part, they were learning from their peers. And I think, you know, it's fair to call them the Irish Lumiere, because they must have been watching a lot of films. And as you know, as we've been saying, they had a natural eye for capturing an image. But the one, of course, that is the really innovative one is the animation. And that's, you know, whenever I write about film, I start with that animation because it's so extraordinary. And it's really witty and it's really fun. And we don't have any other animation from that period, from later, you know, right up into 30s, 40s, 50s. Nobody was doing animation, but somehow they got this idea of animating the clock tower, and they literally twirl it around Youghal. So you can see it on the IFI player, And if you watch it, the clock tower, you know, is standing in place. It's still iconic in Yule. And then it turns around and kind of twirls around the street. And it, you know, it's so fantastic. And how they got the idea and the skills to do that, I don't know. But I think that's the really innovative one.
And if they had maybe decided to animate a mouse, perhaps, or a duck or something like that, they might be now the creators of a billion-euro enterprise.
They might have been. They might have been. And I'm sure they would have done it really well, too. But, yeah, they didn't do any more animation either, which is such a shame because, yeah, it would have been lovely to have seen more animation because they're still taking what they're doing, which is street scenes, but animating them.
Well, tonight we are finding out about Ireland's forgotten film pioneers, the Horgan brothers of Yule. And we'll be back with more about their innovation and creativity right after this. Welcome back. We're Talking History. And tonight we are finding out about the Horgan brothers, Ireland's forgotten film pioneers. And I'm delighted to be joined by Dorina Clancy, director, producer and the creative director of Cormoran's Films. She's the author of The Horgan Brothers, The Irish Lumiere, published by the Mercier Press, and the producer of the T.G. Carr documentary, Na Lumiere Gaeilge. And Professor Ruth Barton of the School of Creative Arts at Trinity also rejoins us, one of the world's leading authorities on Irish cinema. Her books include Irish National Cinema, and Dr. Dennis Condon, who lectures in film at the Departments of English and Media Studies at Maynooth University and who's the author of Early Irish Cinema, 1895 to 1921. Dennis, I'd love to talk about the silent period and filmmaking in here and I suppose how it was developing and how the Horgan brothers were maybe tapping into this rich culture that perhaps we're not aware existed.
Yes, I mean, when you look back at that silent period and you start to see the number of films that were made during the silent period, it's really incredible. And you can see some of this from the documents that come from the Horgan Brothers Cinema as well. You know, what they were showing in a week is the number of films is really incredible. So that a program in the 1910s had 8 films on it. You know, they when people went to the cinema at that time, they went to see a two-hour show like we're used to as well now, usually. We see one film, they would have seen multiple films. And so the program would have consisted of short comedies and then a longer feature film, usually a drama, but also supported by other types of films, some of the animations we've already mentioned, but also interest films, which would have been documentaries and news films, which we've also talked a little bit about, the newsreels and so on. So people were used to seeing different types of film when they went to the cinema. And they also were used to seeing going to the cinema much more often than we do today. They'd go twice or three times a week, and the programs changed that often. They'd even change sometimes every day, depending on the cinema. And so, you know, if you start to do the maths on, you know, you're talking about maybe between 4 and 8 films in each program, and you've got 3 programs a week, and this is 52 weeks a year. So there's a lot of material being made during the silent period. 90% of that material doesn't survive, and that's also the case with Irish material. We are very lucky that we have the Horgan brothers as an example of the kind of local filmmaking that was going on during the period. So we have, as we've already mentioned, the church gate films, which was actually a genre. People would turn up, the filmmakers would turn up outside anywhere really that people were coming out of. So they started off as factory gate films in Ireland, I suppose. We had fewer factories and more churches, so they became the church gate films. But those kind of genres were very, very, very popular all around the world from the 1890s even. Those are popular. But it's into the 1910s, you're starting to see that kind of variety of comedies, dramas, documentaries or interest films, newsreels, all developing through the 1910s. And into the 1920s when really silent film becomes a truly artistic form. And those films that we can go back and see now that we still remember from that period are really made in the 1920s. But so the Irish Lumieres, as we're calling them, the Horgans, are making films that are local films. They don't seem to have made any dramas, but they have made other kind of genres that we'd be familiar with from that period.
And Tarina, there's a fascinating insight that we get from Henry Ford and his interest and his involvement.
Yeah, so we the Horgans have a photograph of Henry Ford outside the Horgan Photographic Studio, and it clearly shows a very young Henry Ford. And like the reality is that a lot of the time these stories travel through the generations in folklore, and you know, you get to two or three generations later and you think, no way that happened, you know. But when you have photographic evidence to support it, there's no refuting it. So Henry Ford would have been working out of Cork and Carrigtwohill, so he would have been very, or Castlemarsh, I think. So he would have been very close. His factories would have been very, very close to the old. Plus the fact that the Horgans would have been travelling to those areas anyway in their own cars to do, you know, different photographic sessions. So there's no doubt at all that they would have met Henry Ford. And again, the cinema and photography studios would have been very innovative at the time and hubs of activity, so to speak. And the Horgan Photographic Studio was a lot of fun. You know, you can see from a lot of the sets that they had that, you know, they had a cardboard or a wooden cutout of a motor car where you just sit into it and you have your photograph taken. It looks like you're driving a motor car. So there's no doubt that Henry Ford would have been interested in this, because again, it's marketing. It's like a marketing ploy. So, and plus the fact that they were businessmen as well. So they would have had good conversations. So the family folklore goes that it was Henry Ford who advised them very strongly to open a cinema. But the delay, I'm led to believe, is because of World War One. Even though they did get one of the first cinema licenses in Cork, they didn't actually build their cinema until after or during the war, I think. And it didn't open until 1917. They would have met a lot of people. And it's interesting there what Ruth is saying about the animation as well. We don't know what other animations they did or didn't do, because we don't know what didn't survive, if that makes sense. We don't know what else they were trying. It's by some miracle and foresight of the generations that came after the three Horgan brothers that have kept the materials in safe places that we know of those materials.
And Tarina, you mentioned about them being businessmen. How successful a business was it?
Well, I mean, it was very successful. As Dennis was just saying, they had a 600-seater cinema that was showing multiple showings a day. And it became very clear very quickly that they stopped making their own films because by 1920, because they knew that bringing in the films from external sources was much cheaper and much more cost-effective for them. And there was also, their cinema was right next door to the Regal Cinema. So you had two very large cinemas operating side by side, literally side by side in the town. And both of them were hugely successful. They were possibly, you know, three of the wealthiest and well-known people in the town. And I know, for example, that they were able to afford a car, one of the first cars in the town. And that business succeeded and continued right up until the 80s. So their legacy was very, very strong. While they may have stopped taking photographs, the cinema stayed open until the 1980s.
And it really was an innovative cinema in those early years. I was reading in the book about how there were these paintings on the walls, and the fact that he used a back projection screen and the projector behind the screen, and that ran into the Horgan family home, that they definitely seemed to have been innovative and creative in the way they presented and constructed the cinema.
They did, and they seemed to me to be all about family as well. It was very much a family affair, you know. So like, it was well known in the town when the cinema was back projection that I think there's a story that if the doctor came in one day and the whole town knew that the doctor was going past the projector because he had to walk past the beam of the light in the Horgan home. But there's, you know, they just made things work. They never really allowed anything to get in their way. If, you know, but they were very innovative, and there is evidence of them also creating a mechanism whereby they could ratchet the film, and they sold that on to the CAM company. So I guess, you know, like any family, they get busy with their children, they get busy with life. So they weren't really interested. They were making enough money to do very, very well, but they weren't really interested in, you know, conquering the world. Apparently, Jim Horgan, their grandson, James's grandson, says that they couldn't afford the patent for the CAM projector, so, or the CAM mechanism. So they sold us the CAM projection system. And that really was it, as in that was their chance to kind of really succeed. But it never happened for them. But they still did very well. They still, you know, were changing things all the time. It's interesting, though, in that cinema, that when they built the cinema, it was obviously, as Dennis will, you know, concur, it was for silent movies. And then when the sound is introduced, they had a huge problem because the hall was so long that there was a huge echo, and the paintings were actually James's paintings, and they were, you know, kind of almost like fresco paintings, so they absorbed the sound, and that got rid of the echo. But I think, you know, and I'm going to let Dennis talk about this. I think Dennis mentioned in the documentary that the orchestra photograph is one of his favourite photographs, but he would be far more well-versed than I would be to talk about orchestras in the cinemas in those days.
Yes, Dennis, maybe bring you in on that about the orchestras, because, of course, that's something that, you know, we sometimes see in movies showing the silent era, and, of course, something that's very much lost to us now.
Yeah, apart from maybe a film festival that'll show a silent film with live accompaniment, you occasionally get that sense. And that's often done with a single musician. In this era, the cinemas distinguished themselves by the number of musicians they had. It was the choice of film, of course, was important, but then having an environment like the paintings on the wall and so on, you know, having an environment that was different from what people experienced at home, you know, and often houses at the time, people didn't have very much, didn't have as much as we have now. They lived in quite frugal homes. And so they go to these, you know, they're often called picture palaces, the picture palace. So this was a different environment. It was luxury in various ways, from the decoration and then the music. And the music was usually, most of the time, produced live by musicians. So it could be a single musician, usually a pianist or sometimes a violinist. But in the better cinemas, they would have more musicians. And the more musicians you had, the bigger your orchestra was, the more you were likely to attract a bigger audience. And so some of the competition was done through the size of the orchestra. And as Darina says, that photo that we have of the orchestra at Horgan's is fantastic. It shows us it's a family band, but it also means that you've got a family who are competent enough in music that they can accompany films, and which is a great skill. Very few films at this time, very, very few, had any kind of a score. So the members of the band would have to be accompanying what was on screen, having maybe not even seen it before, and remain together playing whatever they were playing. Often what they did was they played something that they thought might be appropriate to what's on the screen. They have a repertoire of music and so on. And they weren't necessarily mirroring what's happening on the screen exactly, but they couldn't. But it was that experience of live music with what was happening on screen that people expected to have when they went to the cinema.
Ruth, when reading the book, I couldn't help but think about your wonderful study of Rex Ingram and maybe some of the comparisons and contrasts. Ingram, who went to the United States and became this internationally acclaimed film director, and the Horgans, who were local heroes. But you have really, with Ingram and with the Horgans, pioneers who are advancing filmmaking in this period.
You do, and of course, if you start actually on the history of the Irish in Hollywood, there's just no end to the story. So many Irish emigrated to Hollywood, and we think of the Irish going to America and you know, digging the roads, but many of them went to Hollywood, and Rex Ingram, I mean, did you know, exceptionally well and wrote his films and made short films and eventually made, you know, really great films like Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. But many, many, many Irish went to Hollywood and had, you know, small, lesser jobs, if you like, you know, behind the scenes and working away. So, of course, what's different about the Horgans is that's, as you know, as Dorina was saying, that's not their ambition. They want to be at home. And I do love the photographs in her book, actually, of the family, because they took family photographs. They took their own family a lot by the looks of it. And so, I you know, there's something almost kind of voyeuristic about watching, about looking at photographs of other people's families. But there's gorgeous photographs of little children and then older generations. And so there's much, you know, by staying at home and not, you know, it's a shame they couldn't patent their invention. By staying at home, they kept compact. And they kept, again, as Dorina was saying, they had that reputation. So they could get anywhere, they could take those photographs. And they just seemed to have had a really different, you know, sense of what they could do with their skills. And didn't, I think in the book, don't you say, Dorina, one of them actually married well, because didn't one of them actually marry the organist, the accompanist who they had accompanying the film? So they seem to be quite strategic in how they built the family up.
They built the family up. And Dorina, you interviewed some of the descendants and some of the family members, and you mentioned Jim Horgan there. And both Jim Horgan and Patricia Horgan White contributed to the book. And you get these wonderful insights from the family.
Oh, for sure. I mean, you can't do a study on the Horgan brothers without, you know, because again, there is no source. There is no one place you can go. There is very little on the internet about them, you know, up to recently. There is very little to be found in any book about them. You might get one small article or two small articles, but that's it. So the source really is the people who knew them, you know, and James, Patricia, Mary and Joan, who sadly passed on, and Ted, Charlie, all of their grandchildren, you know, they would have spent time with them, and the stories would have gone down to the family. And it goes back to that folklore, you know, where you think, you know, oh, that can't be true. There's no way, you know, or granddad's only making that up. You know, that feeling that we have when we hear these stories, you know, from our grandparents or our parents. And then when you actually set about really digging deep, you know, the great example of that was at the Gates of Cantin story for me, because when you look at the photograph, it's clearly a Horgan photograph because of the writing and the style, etc. But to the naked eye, it could have been taken anywhere. But yet, there's a Chinese man in front of the gate. So you start to dig. You start to, you know, what exactly? Jim Horgan had the bones of the story, but to absolutely make it copper fastened, to use that word, to make it, you know, academically irrefutable, I did a very, very deep dive into proving that the gates were actually in Marshall Grove in Yule, which is a story unto itself, really. And it was an obscure 1970s article in the Hong Kong Law Society Journal, I think, that where I found the proof that the gates were actually in Marshall Grove, you know, in an academic journal, so to speak. So now, That photograph is now rubber stamped in my book as being 100% Gates of Cantin. But there are very few articles that actually reference Yule. They reference London as the gates, you know, went from China to London. But the word Yule never got into the London newspapers as they would have been at the time.
Okay, well, tonight we are talking about the Horgan brothers, Ireland's forgotten film pioneers. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be assessing their legacy. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We are talking history, and we are talking about the Horgan brothers, Ireland's film pioneers. And it's, of course, inspired by a wonderful new book, The Horgan Brothers, The Irish Lumieres, published by the Mercier Press and written by Dorina Clancy. And she's also the producer of the T.G. Carr documentary, Na Lumiere, Gaelica, and Dorina Clancy is the director, producer and the creative director of Cormorant Films, the author of that book and producer of that documentary. We're also rejoined by Professor Ruth Barton of the School of Creative Arts at Trinity College Dublin, one of the world's leading authorities on Irish cinema and a professor in film studies, and her books include Irish National Cinema, and Dr. Dennis Condon, who lectures in film at the Departments of English and Media Studies at Maynooth University and who's the author of Early Irish Cinema 1895 to 1921. Ruth, I wonder, does all of this new material about the Horgan brothers change how we should approach Irish film history and perhaps even how we should teach it?
I think what it really does, it decenters Dublin. So, you know, so much of when you're looking at early Irish newsreels, and as you know, we've already discussed, they were mostly not shot by Irish newsreel companies, but you're still looking at them as histories. This says, actually, no. There was such life in the countryside, and Yule was, it really brings Yule and the whole wider kind of countryside. And it gives us just this really strong sense of rural life. And I think that's important. And it's also, you know, it is a kind of shame when you think, why were they not tempted into making fiction films? I'd love to know what the discussions around the family table were when they discussed that. And did they make more animations? But I do think it's important when we are in such a, you know, a world dominated by, you know, right now by Dublin filmmaking, that we have this and we have these early films to show, because it just brings other parts of the country into the kind of national narrative around film. And also the fact that they're just so good, these films, is important. It's not like, oh, we found these films and they're kind of okay, but they really weren't up to international standards. These are up to international standards. So it says, you know, we could do it then. Why did we not keep doing it? You know, there's very little newsreel footage, as Dennis was saying. From, you know, when these go away, there's really little that you can see. Why were more people not doing it? So it's there's a kind of slightly sad what if. It started so well. It started with the Horgans. Why could it not have continued more strongly? Because the history of Irish cinema is not a particularly rich one of indigenous Irish filmmaking. You know, really right up to the 50s, 60s, 70s, only gets really, really going in the 70s. So with this long lull where people just didn't think we could make films, but actually we could.
And Dennis, it opens up so many other avenues then for us to try and discover and research about audiences, about missing films, about the work of amateur and regional filmmakers.
It certainly does. I mean, these films are available. They're on the IFA player, for example. People can go and see them. So they are part of our national story for sure already. But they might make us think of the other filmmakers. Dorina has done a very good job on the Horgans. I think there are other filmmakers and cinema owners around the country who did make films, and they don't survive. May encourage people to go back to the archive and try and think about other filmmakers from their parts of the country. As I mentioned earlier on, the Kilgannons of Sligo for me stand out. Many of the films in this period were in the business, maybe in photography or in garage owners and people like that. They were used to working with mechanical devices like cameras. So cameras and projectors and so on. So they were quite adept in pointing, actually having a camera and pointing it at something and encouraging people to come into their cinemas. But they thought of these films really as something that's going to get somebody in for this week, and then we make another one and next week when the next thing is on. And so those films, because there was also no archive, in Ireland there was no archive until the 1990s, that stuff just doesn't survive. We don't have anything apart from the Horgans, really, from those regional filmmakers. It's so good that the Horgan material survives and gives an example of what that might have looked like from other places around the country.
And Dorina, we've been talking about the Horgan brothers, but the Horgan women were also hugely influential and important over the different decades. And I think Maisie Horgan was a crucial pianist, and you have various Horgan women running the cinema over the years, and they play in a very important role in the story as well.
Well, they do. I mean, everybody from Elizabeth, the mother, who was the backbone, really, to the three brothers working and getting their shoemaking apprentice. And I think a huge factor in them being so successful, according to the family, is her influence, without a shadow of doubt, and the fact that there were three of them. I think industrially, the fact that there were three, they were able to keep on producing, keep on innovating, keep on keeping on, so to speak. You know, there were three people able to go into the dark room and, you know, recycle that or whatever. And then later on, then we have Maisie, who is the pianist who married into the family. And the cinema was eventually left to two women. And they ran it right up until the 80s, if not the early 90s. And yeah, so they're very well known in the area. And they were, you know, some great stories about them. Even in another, there's another documentary on them, actually. But, you know, to have such a huge influence and acknowledgement of their input is great.
And Dorina, what do you want people to take away from the story of the Horgans, from your book, from your documentary, from this episode of Talking History? What would you really like our listeners, your audiences, to understand about cinema in this period, about their contribution, about this innovation, about y'all and the wonderful setting that it provided and the inspiration that it provided?
I think what's forgotten in history, but for the Horgan films and photographs, is the wealth of travel that was going on at the time in and out of the town. You had everybody from the most wealthy British governors living in the town and also bringing in guests from all over the world. But you also had poor people excursions from Cork coming down, you know, to visit the seaside. And it's very clear from the films that they literally didn't have a shirt on their back to go into the sea with. So these children were like having a fabulous time in the water, probably seeing the seaside for the first time coming down on the train. There is a wealth of people living their lives. There is a wealth of people enjoying life. And that image that we kind of see from an academic point of view of Ireland at the time is that we were ruled by the British. We weren't happy, that we were really struggling. And yet in these photographs, at the end of the day, people were going about living their lives regardless of their political affiliations, or regardless of any wealth issues. You've everything from people selling cockles on the strand to, you know, agricultural marts. There's just, I think in that photographic collection, for me, it's unique because unlike something like the Lawrence collection, for example, which is, you know, it's towns and villages across the country. Here we have people living their lives very comfortable, very, very happy. You know, in that moment, they seem very content for the camera to be shown in their faces, you know. And I really like the idea as somebody who has, you know, I've done my time in Dublin and my mother's from Dublin, but that there were so many innovations happening outside of Dublin, and that recognition needs to be given for that, even in today's world in production, that there is so much talent outside of Dublin that needs to be recognised as well. And I think they should be the ones who, you know, be remembered for that, really, to be honest.
Well, I think that's an inspiring note on which to end our discussion tonight. My thanks to Dorina Clancy, director and producer and the creative director of Cormorant Films. She's the author of The Horgan Brothers, The Irish Lumiere, published by the Mercier Press. And the book goes alongside that wonderful T.G. Cahir documentary. And it's been the culmination of years of research into the lives and legacy of the Horgan brothers. Also, Professor Ruth Barton of the School of Creative Arts at Trinity College Dublin, one of the world's leading authorities on Irish cinema. Very grateful to her for joining us. Her books include Irish National Cinema and Dr. Dennis Condon, who features in that T.G. Carr documentary and who lectures in film at the Departments of English and Media Studies at Maynooth University. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, and Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so I hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.